From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit misses getting to the finals for the Amazon second headquarters. We'll talk about lessons learned. Plus, more survivors speak to Larry Nassar and to MSU and USA gymnastic officials.
Larry, I hope you, Luanna Simon, Kathy Klagis, John Gettert, and all of the USAG are scared because you have pissed off the wrong army of women.
The takeaway from this week's media previews at the North American International Auto Show.
You know, Detroit held an auto show and its hometown automakers didn't show up.
Michigan writer Doug Stanton's book about 12 American commandos fighting on horseback in Afghanistan.
Ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances. How were these guys like me or like us? Because they live in our communities, but who were they?
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The sentencing hearing for Larry Nassar continues for a third day in an Ingham County courtroom. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been there all week long. Kate, this day began with a message from Larry Nassar. What did he say to the judge?
Yeah, this was an incredibly surreal moment. We didn't know the judge was going to do this. Judge Aquilina opens up the courtroom by saying she and counsel have been meeting to talk about this six-page letter that they got from the defendant, Larry Nassar. In it, he talks about being worried about his own mental and physical health, that he says he doesn't know if he can take it for these 4 days listening to these victim impact statements. And he also really criticized the judge, said she was doing court this way because she wanted the media attention.
Wow. How did the judge respond to that?
Oh, it did not go well. Judge Aquilina did not mince words. She told him that being a part of this was part of the plea agreement, that he knew that he was going to be sitting here listening to victim impact statements, and also that this had absolutely nothing to do with media attention and that if it was painful, he needed to deal with it.
So things continued. We should note, by the way, that MSU President Luanna Simon did attend the afternoon session yesterday. How have the women who were there yesterday and today responded to her presence?
I mean, they're overall incredibly angry, furious at Michigan State University. That is a theme that we hear in so many of their statements. Some of them said that they felt like she was just doing that for appearances' sake, that she'd been pressured into it. However, they were actually angry that she didn't come for this next day. Rachel Van Hollander, one of the victims, apparently told a reporter that she had asked Simon specifically as a favor to her to show up today and that Simon had told her it didn't fit with her schedule. Now, I have not confirmed that with Michigan State University. I've asked them if that's an accurate recap and I'm waiting for them to get back to me. But a lot of women have said that that makes MSU look like cowards in their opinion.
Now, there were more women today addressing Nassar, including some very harsh words for others who they say didn't protect them, including President Simon. And Kate, I understand the courtroom actually broke out in applause today for the first time this week after one woman spoke.
Yeah, Lindsay Lemke is a senior at Michigan State University. She is there as a gymnast on a Fulbright scholarship. And she had some very strong words, not only for Nassar, but also for MSU President Luanna K. Simon.
Your broad spectrum of emails that are sent to everyone, not specific survivors, that states that you are sorry and working to fix this. Please stop and save yourself the pity party. Does that seriously make you feel better? We don't care. It's too late for your sorries and trying to make sure that we are safe. You act innocent. You are hardly a president of any kind, especially of the university in which I still attend. And frankly, I am proud to attend because I am too big of a person to let your small-minded selves ruin my college experience. You are trying to manipulate people into thinking that you are innocent when you are not. As far as I'm concerned, you are just as bad as this monster that has attempted to ruin all of us, but he hasn't and you won't either. Larry, I hope you, Luanna Simon, Kathy Klagis, John Gettert, and all of the USAG are scared because you have pissed off the wrong army of women. Thank you.
That is rare, getting a round of applause in a courtroom like that.
That is the first time that we ever heard the court break into applause, and it's been quite an emotional roller coaster couple of days here. Cindy, I think it's important to remind people that what these women are angry at MSU about is that for 20 years, people at MSU have been getting reports and concerns about Nassar, and he was still allowed to work there and continue to abuse patients. So for some of these women, they feel like their abuse didn't need to happen, that this could have been stopped years ago.
And as we've heard this week, people who were abused even as he was under investigation, and he continued to work.
Right. When MSU did a Title IX investigation in 2014, cleared him in that investigation and allowed him to return to work, even though he was still under criminal investigation at that time by MSU police.
Olympic bronze medalist Jamie Dancher, with whom we spoke on Stateside, also spoke out today, touching on something that I really think a lot of us listening need to hear and need to understand, that it wasn't just these specific people who failed to believe these gymnasts, but the general public as well. Here's a bit of what she said.
When I came forward in August 2016, I was attacked on social media. People did not believe me. They believed him. People didn't believe me, even people I thought were my friends. They called me a liar, a whore, and even accused me of making all of this up just to get attention.
That is stunning when you realize that what people went through just in their day-to-day lives after they spoke out.
And I think what Jamie's statements did, and what so many of these statements have done, is they have been so brutally honest about what their experiences have been like. You know, women have talked about everything from suicide attempts to eating disorders to substance abuse, and they've really laid themselves bare in a real way. And what we're hearing from attorneys, from the prosecutors, is that other women are watching this and are calling up the court saying, you know, I didn't want to make a public statement before, I wasn't ready for it, but I'm watching this now and I want to too. So the numbers of women and girls that we're expecting to hear from keep growing.
In fact, do we hear a hint that this sentencing hearing might actually go into next week now?
Yeah, we don't know when this is going to end. It looks like we're at about 105 women expected to speak. We're about halfway through. So it's entirely possible that we may run into Monday.
Kate, have you had a chance to talk with anyone after they've had that moment where they could finally stand in front of the world by standing in this courtroom and look him in the eye and say what's been on their mind for God knows how many months, how many years? And I'm wondering, was there any sense of catharsis or wholeness restored by being able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get cheesy about it, but I talked with one woman today who is a middle school teacher, and yesterday she had expressed all this concern and really just broke down in the court, talking about how she didn't want to give this statement because she was worried that her kids would see her as a victim or in this weakest moment. And I talked to her today that she woke up this morning to emails from parents and friends telling her what an amazing job she had done. The judge even said to one woman this morning, I see the rocks coming off your back right now. I see you putting this burden down. And I don't think this is going to be like an easy, quick healing for anybody, but I think there's real power in what's happening here.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells with us via Skype from the Ingham County courtroom. Kate, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Cindy.
After Michigan's meteorite show Tuesday night, the hunt was on to find fragments. Two members of the American Meteor Society actually flew here from Arizona hoping to find a piece, and now we hear success. Larry Atkins and Robert Ward have actually found several meteorite fragments. Mike Hanke of the American Meteor Society is with us. Mike, where'd they find these fragments?
On a lake in Hamburg, Michigan.
Okay.
Frozen lake.
Interestingly, that is kind of where NASA said they thought that you would find fragments, was around Hamburg. So what are the rules when it comes to finding meteor fragments? Finders keepers?
It's the property of the land that it landed on. So if it was, you know, found on a farmland, it's the farmer's property. If it's found on a lake, it's kind of public domain. If it's found on a street, it's kind of public domain. I mean, you could have local municipalities, if you found it at a city park, that they may want to lay claim to it. But the general rule is whoever owns the land that the meteorite's on owns the meteorite.
All right. So these two guys found it on a lake, a frozen lake. They've got their bit of space rock. What could that mean for them? Is there money in that if they wanted there to be?
Well, I know that they're sending off a sample to a scientific institution tonight, and it will get classified, and then scientific papers will be written about it. And I think that's their primary motivation, because they're more enthusiasts. Really, it's going to depend on what type it is and how many are found. So it's like supply and demand. The more that get found, the less valuable they are. And I think from what they're reporting, it's a common type. So it's not an exotic type, but it's still great. It's still a meteorite.
So Robert and Larry came here to hunt. They are not locals.
Larry is from Hadley, Michigan. He runs a poison ivy company in Michigan and spends his summers in Michigan and his winters in Arizona. And Robert is a meteorite hunter in Arizona.
And when we talked to you yesterday, you said there are a couple hunters from Arizona on a plane to Detroit, and lo and behold, they're the ones that got it.
Yeah.
What do you tell people who are locally now, let's say in that Hamburg area, saying, ooh, we want in on this too? What are they looking for?
They're looking for something that looks black like charcoal. You know, people need to be careful walking on lakes because you don't want anyone to get hurt. You have to be careful not to not trespass, and it's freezing cold outside. You don't want to get frostbite. And sometimes people can get crazy with meteorite hunts. So most important thing is to not break any laws and to be careful. And in the snow, it might be buried, but it depends on how the wind's blowing. It might just stick out. So like if a meteorite was on top of the snow, you could see it from 100 feet away. Landowners in that area should scour their property. You know what I mean? And
yeah,
just be aware that, you know, weirded people might come by that want to look for rocks. You know what I mean? You might have trespassers, so they should be on the alert. You know, if something fell on my land, I would want to get it myself. So they should look in their yards and fields if they're farming people in Hamburg and Lakeland, Michigan.
All right. Well, two happy meteorite hunters have scored. And it's a good guess there's more fragments there, right?
The field is scattered 10 to 20 miles long and 2 miles wide. So there's a lot of land out there where meteorites could have fallen. And there's probably thousands of meteorites.
Mike, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Still to come, Detroit is not on the short list for Amazon's second headquarters.
We did not make the final list, not because of the quality of our proposal. In fact, just the opposite.
We'll talk about lessons learned. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
You've heard that term, hotbed of innovation, the time and place where money and talent flow toward the creation of new ideas. Sometimes, though, innovation happens during the slowdown, the dry spells. Today's guest on The Next Idea is a metalsmith who's worked on restoration projects like Detroit's Fox Theater, but started working with windmill technology during the last recession when money and projects were kind of scarce. Carlos Neilbach is the head of Can Art Handworks, and he's received a Knight Arts Challenge grant to create innovative wind turbine sculptures that'll power a cell phone charging station and also help irrigate crops in Detroit's Eastern Market District. Carlos Neilbach is with us now. Carlos, welcome to The Next Idea.
Very happy for you to have me.
So describe this project that you're working towards at the Eastern Market using this Knight grant.
Yes, it is really my pet project for many years, trying to create industry here in Detroit where we are so in need of a product, a commodity, and the unique circumstances of the bankruptcy and the despair, you know, that make me increase the search for a solution.
Hmm.
So I set out to build the windmill. I studied all existing windmills and reversed all the criteria, and first and foremost, work with the material and the things that I have currently available.
Okay, so we're basically, we're upcycling what's there instead of spending money fabricating new turbines.
That's the exact word, is upcycling. Taking existing components, find viability in other products and projects, and not melting them in like recycling, rather disassemble them and reuse them in new projects, somewhat like Lego stones, to be able to, you know, make new things over and over again with the same things that you have available. Upcycling.
Carlos, I understand you had an aha moment about windmills while you were installing something on your roof. Tell us about that moment.
Upcycling now, it's almost a lifestyle that you are a keen observer of things that you feel and touch and how they may find use in your projects and inventions. And so my first development of wind turbines, I created the blades that create the rotation on a low level altitude versus a higher level altitude. Blades that kind of catches the wind like a baseball glove, but then divert that to create this rotation. And when I was one day on the rooftop to adjust my satellite dish, a gust of wind came, and just like a baseball glove, I catched a whoosh of wind that almost catapulted me off the building. And there it was. I went straight to my shop and built my next windmill out of satellite dish blades.
Okay.
You know, and that worked so good. My windmills are spinning for 8 years, through all the seasons, through all the storms, through all the power outages.
So you're using upcycled materials, Carlos, things that are used in producing vehicles. So it's not wasting. It is repurposing and building two windmills for the Eastern market, which will do what for the Eastern market?
One will aid to irrigate the urban farm, also mediate storm water. The urban farming right now, it's taking their irrigation water from the tap, from the hydrant, and that presents a problem all by itself. So the need of mediate the storm water that accumulates and overwhelms our drain system right here is just paramount.
So that's one, and then also a cell phone charging station.
Yes. There will be a showcase wind turbine right in front of shed number 5, and it will be located in a flower bed with a seating arrangement around it, like regular benches. But those benches have plugs, so you can charge your cell phone. Hmm. You also could charge your wheelchair or electric bike. And all that with a device that is created by upcycling with materials that's all around us.
And also one that you can kind of take apart and move as needed, which is really the opposite of those huge, big three-blade wind turbines that we see. How do you think this kind of idea, Carlos, can help revitalizing Detroit?
Our greatest resource is creativity. The next generation cannot pollute any more oceans, are not able to hack up any more foresters, all the resources like oil, gas, this is coming to an end. So to come up with a way to see the resources in the things that was already created, I think that the real inventions are yet to come.
Knight Arts Challenge Grant winner Carlos Neilbach. He's the head of Can Art Handworks, and he will be installing two innovative wind turbine sculptures in Detroit's Eastern Market District. Thank you so much for being with us, Carlos, on The Next Idea.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
It's an acronym for a group of industrial chemicals known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They've been used, these PFAS, since the 1950s, and everything from firefighting foam to fast food paper wrappers to stain-resistant textiles and carpeting, waterproof shoes and boots, nonstick pots and pans. You get the idea. A lot of products. Studies have shown PFAS to be linked to various health problems, including a higher risk of some cancers. The chemicals have been found in groundwater in 29 sites in 14 communities around our state. And it seems the more the state DEQ looks, the more contamination it finds. But getting firm answers on how much PFAS exposure is dangerous and how you best clean it up, that's been harder to nail down. Let's get the scientist's take on PFAS as we welcome Tom Bruton. He's with the Green Science Policy Institute in California, and he's written about the need to coordinate health research in PFAS-contaminated communities across the United States. Tom, any idea just how many Americans have been exposed to PFAS?
We do have an idea, and it depends on what level of exposure we're talking about, but the number is in the millions. So a study that we did a couple of years ago estimated, based on the best EPA data that we have, that something like 6 million Americans are served by water supplies that contain levels of PFAS at concentrations higher than what EPA says is safe.
Okay, and where, just so we all are clear, where are the major sources of these chemicals?
Well, one of the big sources actually is the use of a specific kind of firefighting foam that's used to put out liquid fuel fires, so the types of fires that you might have where a plane crashes or where fuel is stored. And so the military, civilian airports, chemical plants, they all use this type of firefighting foam. And a lot of them had training exercises where they would spray this firefighting foam and practice putting out fires. And over time, the foam that contained these PFAS chemicals leached into groundwater. So that's one of the big sources. Another source is industrial facilities where the chemicals were either made or where they were used for other things. One example that's timely right now is the Wolverine Worldwide Tannery there in Michigan, where a PFAS chemical called PFOS was used for waterproofing leather.
Yes, exactly. And that certainly has made a lot of headlines and caused a great deal of concern in our state. And are these chemicals still being used today? So are we opening ourselves up to exposure by buying certain products, for instance?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. And the chemicals that we know the most about, that the harm is the most clear for, have largely been phased out by manufacturers in U.S. and Europe, while they're still made in China. In their place, manufacturers have started using some closely related chemicals. They don't stick around in our body as long. They're not bioaccumulative, and so they're thought to be less risky, but they still share many of the same chemical characteristics. They still are very persistent in the environment, and many scientists are concerned that these new supposedly safer alternatives might not be as safe as the chemical industry likes to say.
So if we've known, Tom, that these class of chemicals can be harmful to humans, it just seems that that sense of what is safe or acceptable is fuzzy. So what do you say to people who have been told, yes, the water in your well has a level of PFAS?
Right. Well, it's always difficult for scientists and physicians to say to someone who's been exposed to a certain level of contaminant, because of that exposure, you are going to experience such and such a health effect. That's just not the way that science allows us to talk. What we can say is that based on large population level studies, we know that exposure to these chemicals does increase the likelihood of various adverse health effects, including the ones that you listed off at the beginning of the segment. So it's hard to pinpoint what is going to happen to any one individual, but we know that on the large scale population basis, exposure to these chemicals does increase the risk of health effects.
Tom, shifting to the cleanup side, what have we learned from other older contaminated sites around the country about what cleanup methods work best with PFAS?
Sure. Well, PFAS, because they're so they're extremely stable chemicals, they just don't break down in the environment hardly at all. They're more difficult to clean up than other types of contaminants. You know, ideally, when you're dealing with a contaminated site, say you can imagine an aquifer underground is sort of like a cup of Coke, and that all the liquid in that cup of Coke is contaminated. You'd like to clean it all up. For other types of contaminants, we have, for instance, bacteria that we can use to clean up all the contaminated groundwater, because those bacteria can break down the contaminants. That doesn't work with PFAS because they're so stable, they're so strong. Instead, all we can do is basically filter out the Coke that's coming out of the straw that you have into this cup. So any well that's pulling up water that's contaminated with PFAS, we can filter that water, but we're not really taking care of the problem. We're going to have to keep filtering that water for as long as we want to use it. So they're quite challenging from the remediation perspective.
As we've gathered from our conversation, PFAS are so widely used across so many industries. Tom, how is the conflict between commercial interests? Here's something that is so useful in so many products, great waterproofing, great, you know, fill in the blank, how many uses. So conflict between commercial interests and public health concerns, how has that influenced our ability to really get a more sophisticated understanding of just how harmful these chemicals are to people and to our environment?
It's a really good question, because like you said, these chemicals are so uniquely useful. They're used in many different applications. But at the same time, we've known for a while, and there's an increasing body of evidence showing that these chemicals, you know, certain of them at least, are quite harmful, and care needs to be taken when they're used. And I think it puts an onus on us to really consider when these chemicals are needed. And are we using them for applications that are critical, where there's nothing else that will work? Or are we using them just because it's easy and they're familiar and we haven't researched potential alternatives that are out there? One example I'll use is that we talk to the outdoor industry, who uses a lot of these chemicals to make really great weatherproof jackets. And while I think it's true that if you're going out mountaineering, say you're climbing Mount Everest, you probably want apparel that's waterproof and is really the best that you can get. On the other hand, you don't need waterproofing chemicals in your surf shorts, and these types of chemicals are being used in applications like that. So I think just some critical thinking about when they ought to be used could really help us reduce these public health problems down the line.
PFAS contamination has been linked to military bases, as you indicated, certainly the now-defunct Wirt Smith Air Force Base in Oscoda, the Grayling National Guard Training Base. Here have been issues here in Michigan. Do you have any information on just how the military is dealing with what it left behind?
The military has actually been fairly proactive in trying to get out ahead of this problem. They realized some years ago that their liability for cleaning up PFAS was going to be quite high. They're the largest user of this AFFF firefighting foam that contains PFAS, and so the estimated number of sites around the country where they may be having to do some sort of cleanup response is in the hundreds. And so they've actually been investing a lot in academic research to come up with new ways of treating PFAS. I think as of the end of 2016, they've spent $200 million testing water supplies at the different bases. And they're budgeting up to $2 billion over the coming decades to fully deal with PFOA and PFAS cleanups at their different installations.
Can you put Michigan's response to our PFAS problems in context? How do we compare with other states?
Well, I think the formation of the recent, you know, cross-state committee to deal with PFAS is promising. It indicates that there's a lot of attention being paid to this now up to the highest levels, and so that's, it looks like Michigan is taking a proactive stance. At the same time, there are some states that I'd say are a little further out ahead on the curve. For instance, New Jersey has been aware of the high prevalence of PFAS in their water supplies for more than a decade now, and so they've had scientists within their state government thinking about PFAS, doing risk assessment, and proposing safer limits. And they've actually proposed maximum contaminant levels for several of these contaminants that are much lower than what EPA says is safe. At the same time, I think that Michigan is ahead of other states. I think there are probably a number of states where PFAS is going to become an issue, but it hasn't yet, and that's largely because, for whatever reason, no one has gone out and looked for PFAS. Clearly, in Michigan, you know that it's there, and so that allows you to start working on the problem, which is good.
Yeah, and that's your proposal to coordinate health research in communities across the country dealing with PFAS. What do scientists like you need to help us? What should people be demanding of their elected leaders?
Well, one of the big issues is a lack of data. Because these contaminants are not regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act, like many water contaminants, utilities are not required to test for them. And so it's hard to know where they are, at what levels, and so it's hard to know where they might be a problem. If there was more mandated monitoring for these chemicals, then scientists and state officials would be able to do a better job prioritizing, how to spend their resources to protect public health. But I also think that increased funding to EPA, to the National Institutes of Environmental Health Science, to the CDC, to the agencies that are in charge of dealing with this problem, would allow them to put more focus on it and get out front of things and think about how they could best come up with a coordinated response, come up with an action plan for the country so that individual states don't have to keep reinventing the wheel and sort of scratching their heads every time a new state discovers this problem and sees that there's not a lot of clear federal guidance on what to do.
Tom Bruton is a scientist with the Green Science Policy Institute in California. Tom, thank you so much for spending time and talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Amazon is out with its short list of the 20 finalists for its coveted second headquarters. Detroit is not on that list. Sandy Barua is president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber, and he is here with us now. Sandy, what's your reaction?
Well, certainly disappointed. We were certainly expecting to be on that list and surprised. I'm going to owe a few people some steak dinners because I bet that we were going to win this or be on the list.
Why do you think Detroit fell short?
Well, we've had a chance to huddle with Amazon at a very preliminary level, a very high-level conversation since the news was announced, and we kind of know some of the general parameters. I mean, first of all, this is economic development of the highest order. This is the Super Bowl, so it ain't beanbag. We're up against, over 230 other proposals from great cities who went all out just like we did. And when you get down to 20, they have to make some decisions. And where we are challenged compared to some of the best-in-class places around North America was around our ability to attract, retain, and develop talent in the long term. We're doing it now. We have a great track record, but it's relatively recent. Southeast Michigan has a reputation for losing people, not gaining people. And when you make a bet as big as Amazon is about to make, you want to make sure that you're someplace where talent is going to be attracted to and can develop over the long term. And secondly, regional transit. Regional transit is something that they cared very deeply about. We thought we had a pretty good answer for them. But again, that was a little bit more future state as opposed to the state of our regional transit system today.
Through the process, Sandy, of developing this bid and this hyper focus over a short period of time on what we can offer, what we've got as a region, what do you think we learned about what Michigan and Detroit can offer and can do?
So we learned a lot. First of all, the muscle memory that was developed in this regional approach led by Dan Gilbert and Mayor Duggan, hugely important for our region going forward. We know we can do big things like this and do them well. I mean, I've been doing economic development for quite some time now, and I can tell you the proposal that we put forth to Amazon in terms of its quality, in terms of its sophistication, in terms of its inclusiveness, was probably the best I've ever seen. And that's the feedback we got from Amazon. I mean, we did not make the final list, not because of the quality of our proposal. In fact, just the opposite. In fact, it was very clear in chatting with the Amazon representatives earlier this morning that Detroit, we were in it until the very, very end.
You know, Sandy, when Amazon made this request for proposals, so this RFP goes out, and business and political leaders all over the country scrambled and fell over each other to try to offer the biggest goodies. Detroit's bid had, you know, big tax breaks for 30 years and 20 years worth of employee state income taxes, and that promise to spend $120 million on talent development. It just seems like cities haven't much leverage in this game, and they have to give away so much. Why do we do it this way?
See, I don't quite agree with that assessment. I know a lot of people think that, but you know, there are certainly economic development opportunities out there that are kind of incentive driven, and individual states and communities have to make a decision if they are going to play that game. In terms of, you know, fight for the very last dollar or put as much money on the table as possible. From our perspective at the Detroit Regional Chamber, we're very selective about when we recommend going after an economic development project that is incentive-based. For example, if it is a low-margin business but happens to employ people with not overly high skills and that we can find opportunities for Michiganders that may lack some of the 21st century skills and it costs us some tax incentives to do that, we would recommend doing that. But, you know, some of these projects where all it is just how much money you can put on the table, we don't always think those are the best way to go. And Amazon, what they were looking for, they weren't looking for the biggest financial package. They obviously, it has to pencil out. I mean, any business decision, I don't care if you're buying a car or a refrigerator or locating your second headquarters, you know, the math has to work and you want value for your dollar. But at the end of the day, they're looking for a place where they could grow, a place that they could call home, a place where they could attract and retain talent.
Sandy, do you think other companies watch this and could see them following Amazon's lead? We'll start seeing more bidding contests between cities?
Well, there's actually nothing new about what Amazon did. What Amazon did in terms of their approach happens every day. I would say our economic development team at the Chamber is working on 50-plus opportunities at this very moment from companies around the globe. So this happens all the time. Amazon got front page news because, well, it's Amazon. It's bigger than a lot of the other ones, and very few companies do a bid for a second headquarters. But, you know, R&D sites and manufacturing sites and logistics centers and kind of, you know, secondary corporate offices, you know, those are economic development project opportunities that are ongoing every day.
Sandy Barua, President and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber. Sandy, thanks for your time today.
You bet.
The 2018 North American International Auto Show has been holding media previews all week long. And tomorrow night is the Black Tie Charity Preview, which raises millions for children's charities. And then the doors open to the public Saturday. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is there at the Cobo Convention Center. Daniel, what are the main themes or stories that you see coming out of this 2018 show?
Well, it's quite a few things in a sense. I mean, we have another round of the truck wars between General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, which is a perennial thing that depending on how product cycles go. And then juxtapose that to everybody saying they're going to get in electric vehicles. Ford said they were going to more than double their spend on electrification from about $4.5 billion over a five-year period to $11 billion. And I think maybe the quote of the week so far has been from Bill Ford Jr., the executive chairman, saying, "We're going all in on electrification. We just hope the customers follow us."
And that is something we've explored.
I think that's clearly one. I think another one was a lead I was playing with, didn't write, but was playing with at one time earlier in the week, which was, you know, Detroit held an auto show and its hometown automakers didn't show up. And what I mean by that is in the two press days, you only had one traditional Detroit manufacturer, Fiat Chrysler, which is legally and technically not based in Detroit or the United States, hold one press conference, its Ram brand, on Monday, and another one with Jeep on Tuesday. No press conferences from Ford or General Motors in either of those press days.
Why is that, do you think? That's surprising.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. Number one, this calendar got moved back so that the first full press day fell on Martin Luther King holiday. And I think that frankly, irritated some of the automakers, felt it would be inappropriate for them to do a big hoopla and launch a product on that day. I think more generally is that more and more automakers are starting to look at and employ off-site events that are not contiguous to the auto show. For example, they launched their autonomous vehicle last week and showed and made the news about that. Ford did the same thing with the Ranger. Technically, it's Ford Ranger pickup. It was shown on Sunday afternoon, part of the proceeding, but really not part of the official press day. So for people that weren't actually here, they would have missed it. General Motors showed its Chevy Silverado a month ago in Texas. They did an event Saturday night. They were the only people doing a Saturday night event. They did an event Saturday night before the press days. And again, for people who are coming in from Europe or Asia, they probably weren't even here by the time they did that.
That just seems counterintuitive, because if you've got the attention of the world, as it will, you've got media coming from all over, why wouldn't you want to maximize that?
Well, you know what I think they would say? We're reaching the audience we want to reach, and they would probably tell you that we don't need to reach the European media. We don't need the Asian media to sell a pickup truck. We need the Americans. We need the Detroiters and the regional people whose publications are read by our buyers. Their buyers of Chevy pickup trucks are not in Japan, South Korea, and Germany. And as a result, I think more and more you see a lot of targeting and really being able to use the power of the internet and the ability to focus on who their audiences are to make these kinds of decisions. So it's not just, no longer is the auto show all things to all people, including all media. I think they slice and dice, and they also do the same thing with executive time. We're seeing fewer and fewer executives. I'm hearing rumors the German auto executives are basically telling people, we're not coming back. There really is not a reason for us to be here. So I think these shows are going to continue to morph. Now, if you're in the market for a car, by all means, you should come down, you should see it. But from our perspective, it's a little different thing.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes checking in from the Cobo Convention Center at the auto show. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Just weeks after 9/11, 12 Army Special Forces commandos secretly got themselves to the mountains of Afghanistan, the first American troops on the ground in Afghanistan post 9/11. The mission? Join with warlords and soldiers of the Northern Alliance and attack the Taliban, and do it on horseback. Their true story was told by Traverse City author Doug Stanton in his book Horse Soldiers. Tomorrow, it opens in theaters as 12 Strong.
It's us. We're going in. We beat out the five other teams. We're going to drop in behind enemy lines, link up with the warlord of the Northern Alliance, General Abdul Dostum. We'll assist him in fighting the Taliban and taking back the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, which happens to be the stronghold and linchpin for the entire Northern Taliban force. The catch is, we only have 21 days.
How many troops does he have?
He's got about 200 paid soldiers and an undetermined number of part-time militia.
What about the other side?
The other side has about 50,000 Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. Missiles, armor, rockets, mortars, machine guns. We're outnumbered.
Just 5,000 to one.
Now, gentlemen, once we land, we're about 9 hours away from hell, which effectively means it doesn't exist. We're on our own. We all need to understand the capture is not an option here. We go in tonight, single ship, no backup. So police your gear, got some rest.
Had a successful test flight?
We are the test flight.
Well, Doug Stanton is with us now. Doug, congratulations on seeing this book become a movie.
Thank you, Cynthia. We just returned from the premiere 24 hours ago in New York City, and it was fantastic.
Well, let's talk, before we get into the movie, I want to talk more about the book. When you found this story, what hooked you? What was the essential question in this story that you wanted to explore?
Well, I think in all of my books, In Harm's Way and The Honesty of Echo Company, and then this one, it's a question, having grown up in Michigan, where I did, what ordinary people thrust into extraordinary circumstances, how were these guys like me or like us? Because they live in our communities, but who were they? And after 9/11, I began to see images of bearded American soldiers in Afghanistan and the reporting, and I asked that question. Were there? What are we doing there? So I just began this five-year journey to find out the human side of their story. I check in with their families, and I also interviewed Afghans. And there's that drives me. But also, in particular, this mission was completely unique in American history in the way it was designed.
Yeah, indeed. In a sense of here you have these 12 guys and on horseback, so fighting 19th century style against 21st century weapons and troops.
That's exactly it. And people say, when I worked with the screenwriters, Ted Talley and Peter Craig, they would call me, why aren't they wearing helmets? Well, they were not wearing helmets because the Afghans, and these Afghans have been fighting the Taliban for 7-8 years before we arrive in September and October of 2001. And they link up with them. They're on horseback. I would get a question, how do they know to speak Russian or Arabic, or some of them speak Persian? That's because they've been trained to do that. They've been trained to be aware of the cultural mores, the religious sensitivities, and go in and not overtake, invade, but to work alongside. Much like in World War II when OSS officers were dropped into Nazi Germany and worked with the underground resistance, get everyone together, let's all stop fighting if we are, and let's fight one common enemy. And in 2001, that was the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
And so now your book is a major Hollywood film with stars like Chris Hemsworth, Michael Shannon, so many more. It's kind of funny. Writer John Bacon told me he once asked Elmore Leonard, do you worry about Hollywood messing up your books? And Elmore Leonard answered him, and I will paraphrase here, Hollywood messes up their movie. They don't mess up my book. And I cash the check. How did you work this process out in your mind?
I worked with Jerry Bruckheimer over a period of about 8 or 9 years, and with the two screenwriters, Peter Craig and Ted Talley. I was on set about a year ago right now when they were filming, and they consulted with me very closely just for these very reasons. This is an action-packed movie, but with a heart, and it dramatizes very crisply in an exciting way this moment in history that began the world we now live in, and it was a successful mission. So, in that regard, I am completely happy with the movie, and so, by the way, are the soldiers who are in it. They were with us at the screening in New York at the premiere, and they have screened it around the country to different military branches, and they have all given it the thumbs up as far as accuracy goes. So it has worked out really well.
Let's take a quick listen. Here is Chris Hemsworth as Major Mitch Nelson. Here he is introducing his team to their mode of transportation, horses.
All right, who's ridden before, anyone?
Summer camp when I was 9.
Cancun, spring break, but I was pretty drunk.
All right. Okay, so kick means go. This is the steering wheel. Left to go left, right to go right. Go back to stop.
Hey, he's not waiting for us. Saddle up.
Doug, that angle of these guys on horseback, that is something so unique. And as you watch that be recreated by these actors, what'd that feel like?
Well, I was there during the filming of the climactic scenes when they do one of the major horse charges, and I've been on a lot of movie sets. I worked for Esquire and Men's Journal and had interviewed actors like Harrison Ford and George Clooney, so I knew that watching a movie being made somewhat is like watching paint dry, even more slowly than paint really does dry. And what is amazing to sit in the huge screen is to watch how big it is. I love movies and I love great television, and it was a thrill to hear lines that I had reported back in a kitchen table in Fort Campbell, Kentucky, back in, say, 2003 or 4, spoken, say, like by someone like Michael Shannon, who's in the movie. Of course, the movie speaks to a large audience, and I think getting this story before the American public, some of whom were only 5 years old when 9/11 happened, and I think that is what is appealing at this moment. This is now history and not just news. And I mean, the book itself, 12 Strong, which is the movie tie-in edition, is now for the third week number one on the New York Times paperback list, so, which is surprising because the movie's not even out yet. So all of it has been really a lot of fun.
Well, it is a great read. I've been power reading it, and it is now called 12 Strong, The Declassified True Story of the Horse Soldiers by Traverse City author Doug Stanton. And then the movie 12 Strong is opening tomorrow in theaters. Doug, thank you so much, and again, congratulations.
All right, thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Could stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. No, I stand my ground, won't be turned.